This event is presented by the Council on Foreign Relations.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone. It's delightful to be here with you and here with two wonderful leaders from different parts of Africa to discuss what I think is the single most important thing that needs to be the result of the COVID pandemic, which is a world much better prepared for future health threats, a world that's able to find them quickly and stop them quickly. And that's the essence of effective response to epidemics. Find it fast, stop it fast. Now, over the past 10 years, there have been various different ways to try to assess how ready the world is for pandemics. And these ways have sometimes been very useful in identifying gaps that countries can address. And sometimes there's been a real question about whether there's an association of that assessment with how countries actually do. This has been a really hot topic during the pandemic, and various groups have come to different conclusions on this. There are at least two widely cited indices. One is the Joint External Evaluation, and we at Resolve to Save Lives have assessed that and put that on our website. There's also the Nuclear Threat Initiative has a pandemic preparedness index, and neither of them correlate wonderfully with outcomes. Our conclusion on that was that even good public health programs could be overwhelmed by bad politics. There are other conclusions and different ways of looking at that according to correcting for how well you detect problems and early versus late response to the pandemic. But in any case, everyone would agree that we don't have a perfect metric, and we may never have a perfect metric, but there's been a suggestion from our group to use what we call 717 as the essential means of assessing and improving and accelerating the improvement of preparedness. 717 says that it takes 7 days and no more to identify every single outbreak that occurs. It takes no more than 1 day to identify that outbreak and to report it to the public health authorities, and also no more than 7 days to have all of the essential components of the response in place. So not necessarily to control it, because that can take more than 7 days, but to have all of the essential components of the response in place. So that's the concept of 717. And I'm really delighted to be joined by Dr. Olalu Adrianola. He is the deputy director of the Department of Health Emergency Preparedness and Response at the Nigeria Center for Disease Control. And I will say that the Nigeria Center for Disease Control, or NCDC as it's known, has made enormous progress in the past few years. Nigeria has made enormous progress with much more rapid detection and control of outbreaks. And this is so important. As you know, Nigeria is by far the most populous country in Africa. And if current demographic trends and projections hold, will overtake the US and many other countries in population in the coming decades. Dr. Adrianola joined the Federal Ministry of Health in September of 2006, and he's worked in hospital services, public health, and family health, cutting across clinical and public health areas. He also led the development of the National Rapid Response Team Training Guide and has coordinated the training of rapid response teams at national and subnational levels. He served as various capacities, including being incident manager for the meningitis outbreak season in 2017-2018 and for the COVID response at the Nigeria CDC. He's currently leading the operationalization of 717 in Nigeria. So I'm looking forward to learning from him. And at the same time, I'll introduce my longtime friend, Dr. Abdul Salam Gay. Dr. Gay is the regional emergency director at the WHO Regional Office for Africa, or WHO Afro. WHO Afro, like the Nigeria CDC, has had a tremendous increase in capacity in recent years and is doing a lot of great work on emergencies and vaccines and other work. And Dr. Gay has expertise in health security, emergency outbreak response, epidemiology, use of information technology and global health, health system strengthening, and was previously the WHO representative to Mauritania. He began his work at the WHO in 2017 as the lead incident manager for major outbreaks in Africa. And prior to joining WHO, he worked for the US Centers for Disease Control for more than a decade in a variety of capacities. He and I met first in a very uncomfortable airport in Africa at the height of the Ebola season. And Dr. Gay briefed me brilliantly on the status of Ebola control in Guinea. He was the field response lead during the West Africa Ebola epidemic. He also was the Benin country representative, strategic information officer in Atlanta, associate director for science in Côte d'Ivoire, and director of global health protection in the DRC. So Dr. Adrianola and Dr. Gay, I'm honored to share this virtual space with you, and thank you for taking your valuable time with us. I'm going to turn first to Dr. Adrianola and then to Dr. Gay for some general comments on response and on 717. Dr. Adrianola.
Thank you so much, Dr. Frieden. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, colleagues from all over the world. It's really a great pleasure to be in this virtual space with distinguished persons. And I bring greetings from the current Director General of the Nigeria Center for Disease Control, Dr. Ifedayo Adetifa, who has sent his greetings to every one of us. And I think, first of all, I need to really thank our various partners, Resolve to Save Lives, Bill Melinda Gates, other partners that have supported Nigeria looking at the 717. I think the first background I will really lay is that, yes, the Joint External Evaluation has really helped countries, but beyond that, there are nitty-gritty things that need to be done to ensure that we really improve on our ability to detect, notify, and really respond quickly at the local level, because we know that once a public health event is detected locally and the response is quick, then we are notification done, we're able to really control that public health event or outbreak quickly. So for us in Nigeria Center for Disease Control, we've been improving ourselves to see how we improve the rapid response teams that move to the support the state. And by the way, Nigeria is a large country, as Dr. Frieden rightly said. And we have three tiers of government. We run a federal system. We have the federal, the state, and the local government. So any public health event has to be detected at the local government first. The state is notified, then the National Center for Disease Control to be able to respond to that. But at times there are delays in this, which are due to several factors in the sense of the capacity at the subnational level to be able to detect this on time and get information across and public health response done. And we've had some issues in which funds have been an issue to really ensure that rapid response teams move to the field quickly. And we have an intervention from Resolve to Save Lives to ensure that we have a pool of funds that we can quickly deploy rapid response teams to the state, to the states. And that really helped because it reduced the time, because before this fund came in, we had an average of 25 outbreaks before the funds, and we saw that it took up to 6 days before that initial response was done. But when the fund came in, it reduced substantially to just 2 days. But that doesn't mean that at the subnational level, response was not done, but most times was not effective enough at the subnational level. Nigeria is a huge country, and the thing is, how do we get the subnational unit, that is our state? Nigeria has 36 states and the Federal Capital Territory, and within those states, you have local government areas. I think the state with the largest local number of local governments is Kano State, that has 44 local governments. So each of these 44 local governments need to report to the state team. And Kano has a public health emergency operations center, and they will need to also support the response. So I guess some of the things, apart from the funds, having quality human resource to be able to respond quickly, having laboratories and diagnostics to do that. And part of the things about the nitty-gritty of this 717 is that it really brings the nitty-gritty of the joint external evaluation, which spans across prevention, detection, and response. I think maybe I'll talk a bit more about how this really works, but it's really pretty important that response should be local. We need to build capacities at the local level. And with 717, we'll be piloting this in three states and the Federal Capital Territory. And this is just a build on other activities that have been done in the state. In Nigeria, we have all the states having public health emergency operation centers. But the key thing is, how functional are they on a day-to-day basis? We just don't want them to be activated once there's an outbreak, which may be picked by, you know, at times may be picked at national level from event-based surveillance. And or these days, because of internet, social media, information moves around very fast, unlike what we had in the past. So these are areas in which I think we'll have more time to discuss of this. But the key thing is about accountability. How do we ensure that partners, philanthropists, put in funds into preparedness activities? It's when we have a prepared workforce, prepared system, that we can respond quickly to a public health event. So if those investments don't come in early for preparedness, and once an outbreak occurs, things will be very slow, disjointed, and it's more like it costs much more. And as you also know, that prevention is always better than cure. And it's also known that when we invest early, we have more returns for that, for the investments we put in. I think I'll just stop at that. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Adrinola. So we heard a few things there. One, the fundamental importance of strengthening, not just at the national level, but at the state and LGA levels, so all levels of government. We heard the importance of prevention, detection, and response, of assessing the rapidity of response, recognizing that the subnational levels may respond, but may not always be effective enough, and the need to increase the functionality of the subnational or state EOCs. Let's turn now to Dr. Day. Salam.
Thank you very much, Dr. Frieden. The World Health Organization in Africa is now following 123 outbreaks. And it is not an exceptional moment, because every year we have around 100 health emergencies. Progress has been made. For example, during the West Africa Ebola outbreak, the median time to control an outbreak was about 400 days. And after, there is a lot of action that were done, and it was reduced to 131 days. And a recent study in 2020, we realized that the median time is 45 days. So we were about to think that it's going well. But the first signal we received was the Ebola North Kivu that lasted 22 months. And we realized that when there is a weak health system, a limited health workforce, inadequate funding, things can get really very bad. And also the COVID, you know, it is now 22 months that we are into the COVID, and it has exposed all those inefficiencies that we discovered in the North Kivu Ebola outbreak. And now actually a lot of ideas are going. When the last time we were counting, we were at 214 recommendations that were done in order to improve the response to health emergency and particularly to outbreaks. And those recommendations was not done by anybody. It was done by a very important organization and institution like G7, G20, the International Health Regulation Review, or the IPPR that was created by World Health Assembly. All those organizations are now thinking about how to protect any part of the world, because we are all safe only when everywhere is safe. So the 717 is, in my view, an excellent idea in order to provide a matrix where we will be able to check the accountability and to see all the resources that we are putting into the system, how effective it is. There is some metrics that exist before, but not very simple. And it was mostly at the technical level and expert level. The 7x7 is really, 717 is very easy to retain. The first 7 meaning that suspected outbreak detection target is 7 days. Public health authority are to notify the investigation is initiated 1 day. And effective response measures are put in place in 7 days. It is very simple and often very easy to make the population or the authorities who do not have health background to understand. I will go through each of those parameters and explain a little bit what is the situation and what in AFRO we are putting in place in order to support our member state get better on that. The first seven is about detecting. In detecting, AFRO has put in place what is called the integrated surveillance and response. It is the last 20 years that in almost all our member states, 46 out of 47, that we put that system. All the reporting process are done in AFRO based on that integrated disease surveillance and system. The integrated disease surveillance and system initially was just about health facility reporting what they have seen to the higher level and the higher level reporting it to the government and the government reporting, notifying it to WHO. While we are going, several improvement was done related to the IDSR. And recently in 2019, a whole revision of IDSR was done, but just before we were about to implement it, the COVID hit. And the COVID came also to teach us a lot of new things. The COVID came also with a lot of determination at the global level in order to make sure that all outbreaks are detected before they become pandemic. In the last 6 months in AFRO, we have been really thinking about it and trying to put in place a system that will help our member state in an interoperable way and also comparable way how to improve the detection system. What we have in vision is a stronger integrated surveillance system across Africa, enabling quicker detection and action to prevent timely response to disease outbreak. For that, we have four pillars. The first pillar is about supporting countries implement IDSR at the national and subnational level, with training, with sometimes supporting even for the data collection tools. And the second pillar is data and information management. We will try to really make easier the data collection, the data analytics, and make sure that something will get out of it for decision making. The third pillar is about workforce development, and the fourth pillar is about advocacy and policy dialogue. Unfortunately, people who are working on data often lack often the social capacity to do the advocacy, and we will try what we can in order to improve that part of data management and analytics. The other is about the notification. The notification is based on a system that exists already. We have to have a country that is organized. We have some authority that those who detected the outbreak should be able to notify the higher level, and the higher level also should be able to analyze it and have also the willing to notify the world. Because people know that when they notify WHO, WHO has obligation according to the international health regulation to notify the other member state. And some member states are very hesitant to really have some issue related to the notification they would do. And the recent example of Omicron in South Africa and Botswana was a really sad experience that do not encourage notification of outbreak. But the pillar that we are trying to develop in order to support our member state are evidence-based planning and policy and legislation, system and tools for international health regulation implementation. Here again, workforce development, and particularly communication and community engagement. Because the notification, it has to start from the ground, from the community. If the community do not want the notification, usually it will not go very far. And the last seven is about putting in place a system that is efficient in responding to that outbreak. And for that, we try really to develop the agility. There's a lot of training that was done and also the workforce. In Africa, we know that our comparative advantage is the workforce. We have workforce who have experience of outbreak and epidemic. Many of those workforce have had measles themselves and they have care for measles and they know often what to do in the diagnostic. That's why also our strategy to support our member state is focusing on workforce. The workforce will be about having an elite workforce of 3,000 people across Africa. And each country will have, if it is a moderate country, around 50 people, multidisciplinary, that we're going to make ready to be deployed 24 hours after the notification to WHO. That idea has been checked with a lot of experts, and also we have experience doing it. We know that often in some countries, they have the resources, the monetary resources, the human resources, but when the notification arrives, they are starting to organize. They are starting to look for operation support and logistics, and all those may take long time. And for us, we want all those activities to be done now before the notification. And we plan to start the deployment on January. 5 countries will be piloted. And by the end of 2022, 15 countries will be reached. And by the end of 2023, we hope to have all our 47 countries that have those workforce, that elite workforce capable of intervening very quickly in order to control outbreak. So I will stop there, Dr. Freedom, and maybe give chance for question and interaction. Over to you.
Great, thank you so much. And we heard very encouraging information despite the huge challenge of more than 100 outbreaks at one time, of building the capacity for early detection, of encouraging reporting despite the problems that we've seen with Omicron and kind of the very unfortunate reaction of governments that hasn't yet been fully reversed, but certainly should be, to lift the travel restriction, which is quite irrational at this point. And the response, with the idea of rapid response teams of at least 50 people in medium-sized countries in at least 15 countries by the end of 2022, and all countries in the region by the end of 2023. So very encouraging. I want to take us to a specific example. I'll ask a couple of questions, and then within the next 5 or 10 minutes, we'll open it up for questions from all attendees. So think of your questions. But let me just have a little bit of discussion first. I want to take us back to one particular outbreak. I saw the analysis that your team made of a monkeypox outbreak a few years ago. And interestingly, the biggest delay was in detection. And that detection delay had two driving forces, as I understood your analysis. One was that the PCR primer wasn't the right primer, and so that needed to be addressed as a technical issue. The second was that people knew they were sick, but they didn't trust the healthcare system, and so they didn't come forward. One of those is an easy fix, one of them is a harder fix. And I wanted to get both of your thoughts on that. And it reminded me of a searing memory I have of that first meeting that I had with Dr. Gay, with Salam, in the airport. It was Mauritania, wasn't it? The airport.
Lomé.
Where was it?
Lomé in Togo.
It was Togo. Lomé. Right, it was Togo. It was a very uncomfortable airport. But you showed me the status in Guinea, and you said, you know, the people in the community, they are saying, this was in the Ebola outbreak of 2014 to 2016, they're saying, you people say you're doctors, and you've been here for 18 months, and you haven't yet treated a patient. It was a searing comment, and it led really to an approach that the government of Guinea led to create a what they called micro-circlage, of a micro-encirclement of having communities not penalized, but actually supported when there was a case of Ebola, so that they would get food and healthcare and other services, so that there would be an incentive to report rather than a disincentive. But Olalu, can you speak about the monkeypox outbreak and the kind of response and how the 717 can be used for continuous quality improvement?
Yeah, so thank you, Dr. Friedin. So the thing with the monkeypox, when it came in, it's about stigmatization. People don't want to be recognized with a particular disease because if you are picked up, you will be quarantined or isolated, I think that's the word. And they don't get to do their day-to-day activities, and they don't feel that the disease really hinders them from their day-to-day work. So the other thing is about economic empowerment of people. What jobs do people do on a day-to-day basis? And what support can the public health system give for that period? So most people in Nigeria, you know, poverty is still on the high side in the country. And people live on a day-to-day basis to earn their wages. And for the period in which they will be in the hospital, they are not really making any income, and they have families to cater for. And they don't see whatever symptom. They just feel it's something that will just be gone over time. And some really didn't really recognize there was monkeypox. Some would just feel it's chickenpox or any of the other infectious disease, in as much as it's not hindering them from moving out. So that is one thing. I think when monkeypox came in, it was rather new. After 40 years in which we didn't have monkeypox just surfacing, you needed to train the healthcare workers to be able to understand the signs and the symptoms, which is really classical for monkeypox. To have this now at the local government level for the disease surveillance notification officer, therefore surveillance notification officer to have this to the all the primary healthcare centers, so that this sensitization gets to the people, and for the people to really know the risk in which they have, in not just them having it, but them also transmitting it to other persons. So that trust with communities, and the way it is at times, our health is public health is not so robust that we've had engagement with the community before an outbreak. You just find the healthcare system now coming for the first time to a community or to a home because there's a problem. But the thing is, how do we really move from that to going to preventive things, that you are going to a community before any outbreak has even occurred, you've gained their trust, they come in. And the other thing is the out-of-pocket expenses for public health diseases, treatment is usually free. But the other thing is what of the income those persons would have made within those period in which they will be in isolation. So that was the issue. But I think we're able to break that ice when somebody fresh from outside the community noted this, brought it to the attention, and was now able to now gain the support from the patient to now come into treatment. The patient now understood it, then other actions now got in place. You mentioned about the technical issue about PCR. Yes, we didn't have that capacity, but we now have it, and we can now test in country. So that is more or less the process. So looking at that 7, you wouldn't blame the rapid response team for not being able to do, for the health system not being able to detect quickly, because you need community buy-in. We need communities to report. In fact, the Minister of Health would say we are all disease detectives. It's not just limited to health personnel only, but also to the public to be able to report this, and for the public to be supportive, not to stigmatize people who have these diseases, could actually deface people and all that. And I think with monkeypox, we've even had the issue in which someone committed suicide, because of the not having that community support and people just ostracizing you. So these are issues that we really need to continue to improve and work on it, so that this doesn't spread. And it's been known that some cases have been exported out of Nigeria. And the key thing is it's about the incubation period, which you'll not be able to pick on time. So that's one other aspect. So it's about once we detect, we notify on time. And I think our capacity has been built to also test for this. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to, I will ask one more question, then we'll open it up for questions from the group. It's a small but super high power group with great people. So we can have an informal discussion in the second half of this hour. But Salam, I want to discuss with you the issue of accountability. You raised it with the kind of perverse incentive. Now, if a country reports, they may have a negative impact, as South Africa and Botswana, for example, are having. That's a real problem. We've heard from the example of monkeypox how applying the 717 metric can identify a quick area for improvement, meaning fix the PCR primer availability, and a bigger issue that's going to take longer, but at least identifies quickly what needs to be done in community trust. But a broader issue with 717 as a metric is, will countries be willing to be assessed on how quickly they're finding and stopping outbreaks? And there's always a challenge within WHO of getting countries to buy in, on the one hand, to a process but also keeping the process real, accurate, and honest so that we are all seeing the same information. 717 is a metric that can do both things. Potentially, it can allow rapid and continuous quality improvement at the country level, but it could also give donors such as the World or organizations such as the World Bank and bilateral donors information on whether their investment in improving the technical control is actually working and making progress. How do you see that dynamic playing out in terms of accountability?
Thank you very much, Dr. Friedan. You raised initially two important issues, the community part and also the technical part. In terms of accountability, when you see at the community level, there is a way in the traditional way in Africa where accountability was usually exercised into the community. For example, we do believe that often an individual exists and is real only because it belongs to a community. And it goes to a level that in some community, doing the authorization to do a study or anything you wanna do, if you discuss it in a community, it has more chance to be accepted and to be used as an only. And also at the technical side, we talk about it, there is some issues that are there that have a long history. For example, at some point, we were saying that primary health care didn't need laboratory. And the investment was going mostly on clinical and laboratory was neglected for a long time in Africa. And that's only recently with HIV and also malaria that a lot of investment was done on the laboratory. So the technical will happen less often. Now, in terms of accountability for the government to accept to be assessed, to be evaluated, and sometimes even to be evaluated by their peer or the countries. It doesn't exist one solution for all the countries. But our experience in WHO has been that the government accepts when we ask them to be assessed. The joint external evaluation, you see in Africa, almost all our countries was assessed. The rare country that initially did not start has accepted now. It is just because of COVID that we were not able to do the assessment. And the joint external evaluation, even though it was a very innovative and new ideas that were very useful, had kind of some issues that we discovered with COVID. Some countries that rated very high was in reality not ready. And now I think the 717 may be not completely an alternative, but it is an add to the joint external evaluation or to whatever gonna be here after we assess and propose something new. And I'm absolutely sure that if we do a progressive and convince the country that it is in their interest to accept, they're gonna accept to do the assessment. The problem is, will they accept now to correct what we have seen? And correcting it in a developing country where resources are lacking, it is a matter of prioritization. It is a matter of negotiation. Often, the Minister of Health and the health authorities in country do not have it. When you go to the protocol of the government in Africa, the health minister is most of the time at the bottom. They are not on the first five in terms of protocol. And I believe one of the things we should attack is try to demonstrate. And when you go to every family, they're gonna tell you that health is our first priority. Why at the ministerial council, the health minister is at the last priority? Those kind of things, I think we should be thinking about it. And once the health ministers and the health authorities have more power, now bargaining power in the government, the accountability of health effort and accountability of health decision will be taken more seriously by the government. So I will stop there, Dr. Friedan. And I think it is a very interesting question that needs further discussion.
Great, thank you so much. I'll invite anyone who'd like to raise their hand or put a question in the chat if you prefer. And while we're waiting, I just also want to see whether Asalam and Olaolu, if you would like to ask each other any question in this conversation, anything you'd like to highlight or bring out.
I have an interesting question because I just learned that Nigeria is piloting the 717. And I just wanted to know, what was the tipping point? Why did you decide that it is time to find a metric tool in order to measure our performance in outbreak response and detection?
Okay. Great, Dr. Salam, for that. So the thing with Nigeria is most times, yes, we have rapid response teams that would be deployed, but the thing is, how quickly do they get deployed? What are the challenges? And what are the key indicators we really want them to achieve? Yes, before we deploy at the national level, there are terms of reference which we expect them to meet up with. But those terms of reference, they more or less vary from one outbreak to the other. So it's really not standardized to now be able to say, okay, how well did this RLT team perform against the other? So the thing is that it really helps to look at what really happens at the subnational and local government level. The JAE, as its tool, as it's used to really assess at the national level. Nigeria has 36 states and the Federal Capital Territory. So you may score a bit very well at the national level, but there are some states, communities in which their capacity is very low, and you'll be missing out some of those aspects. So once health event is detected, notification, and that matrix is put in for accountability, be able to really check that key things have been done. Yeah, your rapid response team may be deployed to the state, and the key thing they just do is about advocacy. How do you get the local level to respond more appropriately to that? And at times it takes a lot of time. And other parts, which is the epidemiological investigation that needs to be done, the risk communication, is now giving just a very little time. And if you put people under some pressure, within 7 days, we want you to have achieved all these metrics, all these key performance indicators. The team will be more focused to get that done within that short time. And that's what we really need. We don't need IT teams to be on the field for a long period, the extensions, because there are some other issues, but it really makes them focused. And we'll be able to use that to really see, okay, what are the challenges with this community, with this state? Are there testing issues? And this really helps to check the whole system as a whole. Our system for vaccination coverage, yes, will be higher at the national level, but you now get to a community that there's an outbreak. And you now see that in the vaccination, a particular group have been left behind. That's why they have that outbreak. So be able to call the responsible agency in terms of vaccination coverage. This needs to be done. We say we have a good sample collection system, but most of the outbreaks have been occurring in probably towns and cities, but haven't really been in the interior parts of the country where it might even be difficult to transport those samples, or there are places that are not motorable. You have to go by other means of transportation. So it highlights all those key areas that need to be improved so that responsible authorities within government does that. And as we know, all these don't fall within the health system alone. We have issues of water, sanitation, food security needs to be there. We are looking about education, health promotion. So these are things that cuts across several spheres. And at times, you know, for Nigeria, we have security issues. So what has been the linkage between the health system and security agencies to be able to respond to public health events within that locality? So having this matrix really helps to look at those key areas to the performance of the country. JAE is at the high level, but by the time you use 717, you can pick things at the granular level to develop in those aspects. And once something is picked in a state, it serves as gaps and lessons learned in one particular state, which other states can now adopt and improve their own system too. So it's about documentation, accountability, and when all this matrix is there, you get funding from government or from partners. They really know how you are investing on this on the funds to do to get this, and it will even open their eyes to other aspects of the system that is not where it's supposed to be to improve, like that data collection. Now, yes, you have summers in all the local governments, but we know that that will still not be enough. Where we still want to get half summers to get to is to have it in all the health facilities. So it's still work in progress for us in the country. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have a question from Lyric Hale. So if you can unmute yourself, we'd like to hear your question. And I'm going to come back after this with a broader political question about 717 and primary health care. But Lyric Hale?
Thank you. I might be leading into your political question, actually. And thank you so much. As I listen to you, I'm trying to get my arms around the incredible challenge that you face. And one question I have is, how do you coordinate with partners? Of course, there's the World Health Organization, but what about NGOs? And I'm very curious about any Chinese role that you see in healthcare response. Is there an effective coordination, and are you getting what you need other than funding from partners, given that, for example, the vaccination rate is so low for COVID in Africa? Are you getting the help you need to face this incredible challenge that you have? Thank you.
Thank you. So two questions, one on partnership in general and one on China particularly. Let's go to Dr. Olaolu first and then Dr. Salam.
Okay, so thank you for the question. So I guess for the things about partnership, in Nigeria, we more or less work with several partners, not just the technical development partners, also have funding partners too, and also NGOs. So there's a coordination mechanism at the Federal Ministry of Health, then also at the NCDC, in which we have all these partners there. And we reach out to them, not just at the national, but also at the state. There are partners who work at the federal level, and there are partners who work at the state and local government level. So the thing is that some of the NGOs, like the Red Cross, MSF, they usually work in those states in which they have a lot of coverage in what happens. And at times, they get the signals even earlier than us at the national level. And when we have treatment centers, you only have MSF being at the forefront, and the community is more willing to share information with them. So like the links to the national for us to really have that partnership. But the other intentional thing is we've been doing is to really reach out to the private sector to be able to fund preparedness activities so that we can leverage on these funds to be able to respond appropriately. COVID-19 has really brought the key things out. People now really know that health is really wealth. And if the country is not healthy or there's a pandemic, everything grinds to a halt. In Nigeria, we had a coalition of private sector coming on board, close to about 100 of them coming together, raising funds and providing the personal protective equipment, helping to establish treatment centers. And they are the ones running those items themselves. So the accountability is with them. We just have our plans, tell them where they fit into the plan, and it runs on, and they have direct contact with the community. Because at times we have issues of the community trusting government. So the private sector partners, NGOs can really break this ice and lead that process while we go with them. Even at the states, we don't respond to public health events ourselves. We usually ask the subnational, the state epidemiologist or the local government disease surveillance notification office is the one who leads us to the community, and we support what they do. So more or less, it's still much more work to be done. Most times people don't know the effect of getting funds early in preparedness, and it's when an outbreak occurs that the funds now come in, but it comes in too late at the cost of several people's lives. I really want to reduce mortality and morbidity to a very large extent so that we keep everybody safe and healthy to contribute to nation building.
Thank you. Dr. Salam, anything you'd like to add?
Thank you very much. How coordinate with partner? It's very important, I think, the partnership, because nobody can do it all. And there's a place for everyone. And when you go to the 717, to come back to the topic that we are discussing, the 717, sorry, I can't turn off my phone. The 717 in the different point where it is, the 7 for the detection. usually when you go to fragile countries where the health system and even the government is not everywhere, that's the NGO that are there working with the community. And when something happens, often that's the NGO that are detecting a problem and report it to the higher level or sometimes directly to WHO. And it happened to countries like sometime in DR Congo, in South Sudan, in the Central African Republic. Often we work very closely with NGOs that are on the field that are doing the notification. And sometimes also the government is working with us directly. And when you go, for example, for the notification itself, in the international health regulation, it is authorized to WHO to look for other source of information when we think about something that the government is not notifying. So there the partners also may play a role very important. And where the partners are the most important again is when it comes the time to respond. When you go to some countries, you have hundreds of millions that are available to respond. There is hundreds of people that are available to respond. But when a notification happens, nothing happened because there is no process for emergencies. Most of our government, when you go to the governance system, there is a way to do procurement, there's a way to do recruitment, but there's no way to do it in emergencies. And that's the partner that had that capacity. When we were in CDC, for example, in DR Congo, it was possible to just mobilize $10,000. And Resolve to Save Life also is doing it often. And I usually would say that you have the most useful money I have ever seen. Because the small $10,000 are able to bring people very early when it is needed. There's $100 million that are available. But before those $100 million are mobilized, we just need to give food to our responder. And that's sometimes what Resolve are allowing us to do. To go to our particular member state, China. At each member state, WHO, what we do is we do policy dialogue with them. That is on the global level. We don't do that in Afro with China. But strategic support, we receive some strategic support China having with our member state, and we try to really orient them toward what is the best in terms of public health investment on those countries. In technical support, it is not a lot because of the language barrier. Often it is a problem to identify some Chinese who speak English and French. That's what mostly the Chinese diplomats are telling us when we ask for technical support. And sometimes in service delivery, China is often here sometimes to provide supplies. You see that on the beginning of the COVID, there is a lot of supply of personal protective equipment that were provided by China. And also now actually vaccine, there is some vaccine that are provided by China to some of our countries. So China is a valuable member state to WHO and we are working with them. In terms of funding and the support we need, like the vaccination example of COVID, the vaccine rates are very low. And unfortunately, having vaccine is the first thing. Often for a long time, we did not have enough vaccine. And it is really very sad because the African most of the time had the money. It was not about not having money. Because when you compare the GDP difference between Africa and the rest of the world is a lot lower than the vaccine difference between Africa and the rest of the world. And also many countries try to do their best to buy a vaccine, they couldn't have it. But vaccine is not the only thing, the supply thing. There is the demand. And at the population level, some population, because of the information they have and so the problem of trust and the problem of saying, who do you represent when you come to propose a vaccine? Usually we have problem really to identify who we are. Is it the government that sometime were not here when they need them? Is it us who are coming to provide them some care that they don't need because they have their children that are sick, but you did not provide that care? That's that trust issue that create a problem of demand in addition to many other issues like the infodemic and other issues that WHO is trying to attack. There is also behavior. The behavior is not behavior of the population, but behavior of the healthcare workers. When a healthcare worker is in a place, he's a reference. If he's not vaccinated, most of the people will not be vaccinated. And also if the healthcare worker is not saying good thing about vaccination, just because they did not receive what they were expecting from the vaccination, it is also another issue. And finally, there is the problem of policy. Usually, we have a lot of policy that may not be in advantage of doing vaccination. For example, it is not directly related to vaccination, but when you go to the test and treat, actually the RDT is not in many of our algorithm. People prefer to do PCR. In vaccine also, there is some policy where the vaccine that is available is not authorized by the country, which is also another issue. Sometimes it's not authorized because of some doubt they have on the vaccine, but most of the time it is related to geopolitical issue where the vaccine is not coming from the friendly country. All those are some issues that we are facing, and we are working with government and all the partners in order to solve them. So I'm gonna stop there, Dr.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm going to end with one broad question, and it's about political support for public health and primary care from within countries. What we have concluded is that to make progress in public health, you need technical rigor, operational excellence, and political support, or TOP, the three legs of the stool for progress in public health. And 717 gives us certainly an opportunity to have a technical assessment. It gives us an opportunity to improve the operational management. The question is, how can we increase the political support for public health and primary health care, as evidenced by continued and increased national investments in health, national investments in healthcare workforce and public health workforce, the pay scales and the benefits of healthcare workers and public health workers. In the CFR context, the Council on Foreign Relations, we've had a series of meetings on primary health care. And we've identified, it's very clear, easy to identify what's needed. And it's very easy to identify the problem of why what's needed isn't happening, because the financial incentives aren't there. What's really hard is, how can we build the political consensus within a country to support public health and primary health care generally? And in specific, are there ways that 717 can help to build in-country momentum for progress? Maybe we'll start just brief answers with you, Dr. Olalu, and then we'll have Dr. Salam finish us up. Dr. Adrinola?
Okay, so thank you. So I think the political will in Nigeria is certainly there, but the thing is funding. How do they move a lot of funds to the health sector where you have other sectors that also have issues? So that's that one aspect that we have in the country. But for Nigeria, we have the executive and we have a very vibrant legislative arm of government that does oversight, ensuring that primary healthcare really gets the right funding that is needed, knowing that that is the base of the health system. And I think a lot of work is also done to also ensure we have more persons covered under the National Health Insurance Scheme, ensuring that it's universal health coverage to prevent, to reduce out-of-pocket expenditure. So this is something that probably there's been a lot of talk, but we need more action to be done. And with COVID coming on board now, I think governments have now realized things need to be put in place. In Nigeria of now, the National Health Act is currently being reviewed so that more funding really goes to primary healthcare. And also noting that prevention of disease outbreaks is also key. So that is also a component of the National Health Act, so that there'll be more funding for public health emergencies. And even with COVID-19, we now have a public health law that is in the legislative, so that we now have a system in place so that there wouldn't be really ad hoc systems to be able to respond to public health events. So 717 really helped to ensure that we look at the base, we have the data to be able to inform policy and to also be able to lobby to get things done within the with politicians. The legislative arm has really been very supportive in the country, ensuring that the executive does the funding, and funding is well accounted for. I think accountability comes into play, and 717 really help in that aspect with the 717 project starting in Nigeria. Thank you.
Great. Salam, final comments.
I will start with the political will and go to the primary health care and how 717 can help in all this. The political will, in my opinion, exists already. What is lacking often is in the health sector, we do not have the skills in order to translate the political will in the right decisions. When you saw the go in many governments in Africa, where often it is the president's, the executive branch that is very strong. And the president is always talking about all they have done in the health sector. But when you go deeper, you're gonna see that they have built some prestigious hospital, sometimes that do not have the workforce they need, or some material that do not have the expertise, and also some really very specific disease and specialty that have had more consideration that it deserves in terms of priority of the country. What? Because the president or the executive branch know some professor who are talking well, but in their narrow specialty, and that's where the investment is going, where, for example, when they invest $1 million to build a cancer institute in a country, that $1 million could vaccinate a million children, and which is more for in terms of investment. So I believe that where we should be developing our capacity and skill on the health sector is how to translate the political will of our branches into real decision. There is also some time there where they even don't have political will because of war or because of other priorities that may not be held. But often, most of the leadership in Africa have a political will in terms of health. And it is also the same reason why the primary healthcare is neglected. It is some investment that are not visible, and people can't go and launch it and pass through the TV. And usually they will not put the most money. It is a little proportion of the budget, of health budget, that are gonna go to primary healthcare. And how can we do with 717 in order to address part of those issues? I think one of the two organizations that can help us is the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and IMF. They have regular report where they are saying the state of the economy, the state of trade in the country. I think that their primary objective is not to shame countries, but it happened that they are ashamed because they are in this situation and they want to do better the next time. Maybe if we have 717 and some very simple report where we're going to say, for example, Nigeria have beat all African countries in terms of outbreak response this year. And maybe the other country that I will not name is on the last, while we know that they don't have the lowest GDP, maybe those kind of report, if it is well known by the population and well known by some decision making, can make some differences in terms of having political will and making the right investment in health. So I'm gonna stop there, Dr. Friedan, and it was really a very interesting question.
Thank you very much, and thanks to both of you for spending your time and sharing your experience with us. We've heard about the enormous challenges that are faced with the number of outbreaks, the lack of community trust, the lack of resources, but also we've heard about the real richness in terms of human capacity of the people who have had experience with outbreak detection and control, and the potential of the 717 metric to accelerate progress, to lead to rapid cycle improvements, and potentially to lead to more political commitment within countries and globally so that we never have to face something as devastating as COVID again. So we'll end the session here. Thanks to both of you. Thanks to the participants. And this will be posted on the CFR website.
For more event audio, subscribe on iTunes or visit us at cfr.org.